Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Michael and Patty Show. I'm Michael.
And I'm Patty.
And today we're covering all kinds of neat stuff about Prince Edward Island real estate and PEI in general. So stay tuned and we'll start with our first topic. And incidentally, did you know that Michael and Patty Show, the acronym is MAPS?
Just pointed that out, which I think it's actually pretty cool because the whole purpose of this podcast is to help guide people through the buying and selling process.
I just recognized this 57, 58 episodes in that the acronym was MAPS, which is pretty cool. So you wanted to bring up the topic of selling homes with tenants in it. Is it a con or a con? I think you've got pros or cons.
I would rather deal with a home that is vacant or that is owner occupied versus a home that is occupied by a tenant. Now, there are some lovely tenants, so this is nothing against any of them. However, there are many tenants who do seek out the opportunity to try to sabotage the sale of the property by being present at showings and telling all the flaws of the property so that they feel they can secure their residency within that unit. Have you found the same?
I just find it hard to believe that grandma's died like four times and they all have illnesses pretty well every time there's a showing. And the husband's working shift work and he hasn't slept in 3 days. And the list goes on and on and on. And if you do happen to get into the units, like you say, they'll hang around and with all the curtains will always be closed, the heat will be cranked up to 91 degrees Fahrenheit, and it just won't show well. So yes, I've experienced that before.
I did have a quick story, Michael. I had a property in Summerside that I had listed, and actually, I didn't have it listed. I was representing the buyer. My buyer wanted through the property, and there was a tenant in the home that kept, after a month and a half, avoiding us getting through. Well, my clients were absolutely in love. They loved the pictures. They loved the home, the curb appeal, and were getting a little bit frustrated with me saying, why can't we get in and view the property? What I came to learn after was the tenant was trying to stall because they were making arrangements to try to purchase this property. Now, this is something that I've done, and I don't know if you've ever done this before. I told my clients to force the hand and to ensure that they get an opportunity at the very least to view. They needed to put in an offer, which is exactly what we did. We put in an offer subject to viewing, negotiated a contract with the seller, and now the tenant was forced to allow us into the property. My clients live in that home today, just so that you know the ending of it. So these are some of the things that you can do if there's tenants that are causing delays. But I had some really good, confident clients that were feeling like they could do this.
I think from a listing agent's standpoint, my best methodology I've discovered over time is I let the owners of the building set up the showing so I don't have to deal with all the drama because the tenants are going to act differently towards the owner of the building than they're a listing agent.
Most times. Now, I have had a property in Charlottetown that I've sold this year. It was a triplex and the most amazing little community that lived within this home. They all worked together. So, you know, great job to some of the tenants that understand the seller's, you know, circumstances, reality. But just be mindful of what you can get into if you're trying to sell a property with tenants in it.
Moving on to an offer I received. This offer said that they wanted all the furniture removed. Would that concern you from a legally descriptive point of view?
I don't know.
What's furniture? Is a microwave table furniture? Is the kitchen table furniture? Are the pillows that sit on the couch part of the couch? For me, I looked at that. I thought this is legally indescriptive because we don't know exactly what is deemed to be furniture. And what I suggested to this particular vendor slash owner is let's make a list of things we're going to remove and identify their locations. And we'll attach that in a schedule to say, this is what we're removing. So there's no confusion. It's just as bad as these offers that you see come in that say, well, it includes everything, but the vendors can remove their personal belongings. Well, personal belongings could be my kitchen table because it was a wedding present and the fridge was given to me by my grandmother. And like, it's not legally definitive. And what I worry about is closing time comes we're ready to get the deal done that afternoon. And then because the way the contract is written all loosey-goosey, we don't know exactly what the purchaser was referring to in the form of furniture.
That actually happened to me about 8 to 10 years ago, where
it happens all the time.
I wrote a contract, and I know exactly what you're saying. I wrote a contract saying that the seller was allowed to remove personal items. This was a fully furnished cottage, very nice. I mean, some things were okay within the home. Come to closing, my clients are in the U.S., and everything but the kitchen table was taken, and they left some file cabinets in the kitchen as cabinets for dishes and that going forward. Now, my clients, I have a very good rapport, and I'm still good friends with these particular clients. However, this could have went really, really bad, and my clients could have been extremely upset with me. I could have been on the hook for possibly having to supply some funds towards replenishing these furniture items that were missing. So after that, I do one thing a little bit different than you, Michael. I always request whatever the shortest list is, that's the list I want. The items you're taking or the items that you're leaving. Whatever the shortest list is, please provide that. And so we have no miscommunication, because I don't ever want to live that moment again.
And make it concise. Note the location in the structure, the house or the cottage. And I mean, if you want to get really fancy and you have all kinds of time in your hands, include a picture.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
You have a note here about how do real estate agents get paid?
Yeah. I find many don't understand how real estate professionals get paid. So therefore, they just assume, you know, we're walking keys. We're working on a volunteer basis. Well, to start with, in some senses, we are. We're volunteering our time to you with the hope and expectation that we are going to be compensated for our time. Many do not understand that. They think they're just one house. I'm just looking at one house. What's the big deal? Well, in a run of a week, we could have 12 of these. I'm just one person looking at one house. And guess what happens? We have no money at the end of the week, or no promise for a closing to come up in sometime in the next 2 to 3 months. And we have nothing to feed our children. We have nothing to pay for the roof over our head. We show up every day hoping, with the expectation that we have loyal clients. And the reason I'm showing this home is because we have an agreement to work together so that I will hopefully get compensated. Now, secondary to that, each real estate agent has a split with their brokerage. Different brokerages offer different splits based on different services that they provide. So there's a split. We'll say on average, it's around a 70-30 split that on average you'll find in the industry. From that, the 70% that the realtor takes, they have to pay CRA. So if they're not incorporated, they're already paying about 40% of that to CRA, or having to put that aside at the end of the year so they don't get bit in the butt by not having income tax taken off, because they are sole proprietor. They are individual businesses. Their brokerages are not responsible for their Canada pension contributions or their remittances for their income tax. After all that comes out, then they still have all their expenses, their gas. Sometimes if they're buying closing gifts, like all of that comes out of their check, and they're left with a very small amount. So if you question that realtors get paid too much, really rethink that statement. Majority of the time, we are actually in the negative when you look at the time invested and all our resources and our skill set, if you're hiring a professional that's got all the training behind them.
And if I am new to the island, or even if I live on the island and I'm not really in tune with real estate or real estate agents or brokerages, and I notice there's over 500 agents now because of the COVID-19 real estate agent licensing boom, what credentials, or would it be a good idea to look with four agents with certain credentials that would serve me better when I'm listing my house for sale or I'm looking for a buyer's agent?
And that's a really good question, and one that I don't feel majority of consumers out there understand or realize. They just assume that, well, they're a licensed realtor, so they have all the training behind them. We get the basic minimum training so that we hold a license. Anything that we actually need to do our job better is on the realtor's shoulders and responsibility to seek out themselves. So there's two different, and it's a good point, Michael, two different considerations of credentials. If you're a listing If you're a seller looking for a listing agent, you want to make sure they have, you know, great negotiating skills. So there are credentials out there. I know our office, and I don't need to be doing a plug, but everyone, when they join my office, it's all covered. They have to take, and there's different levels of negotiating training. So I am confident that my office, every agent in there has their negotiation certification. They should have some sort of marketing. There's a course called, and I know you have this, Michael, ePro. It's a complete marketing program.
There's a bunch of marketing credentials, and they're all good in different ways. But if you're hiring a listing agent, they should have a lot of credentials that are geared towards the marketing of that property, which will give them more money and sell it quicker.
Correct. And you want to make sure that there's also listing agent programs, understanding how to stage your home, understanding how to show your home, therefore making sure that you present your home for the buyer's agents that come through and show it. So there are credentials and training that your agent should have. Look at their email signature. Do they have any acronyms? Look at their website. Do they have any acronyms following their name? These are very important. Now, if you're a buyer looking for an agent, one of the top ones that has been pretty much offered for free this year all across North America is ABR, Accredited Buyers Representative. This is a great program. Again, a program that every realtor I know in my office has gone through. I absolutely insist on this. Negotiation, both sides of the transaction. You want to make sure that your agent has some sort of formal negotiating training, not just that they can say, well, I know how to negotiate, because many think they do and they don't understand there's so much more behind the negotiation, where you're getting into cultures and generations and mindsets and positions and different styles that people take on. Negotiations is one of those fundamental courses that I think they should have. Plus, there are so many more planning for, you know, retirement. There's training courses. So really check the email address or their website and ask them, what kind of formal training do you have aside from your real estate license? And there's nothing wrong with asking that.
And ideally, look for what we've defined in the past as an expert in an ideal world, which is someone that has 10,000 hours of experience in PEI real estate, not real estate in other provinces or states. And
I was going to say someone that does it preferably full time, because they're going to be available to you and not having to wait until their shift ends and they're available to start taking your calls, deal with perhaps a situation that might have arisen.
And that's why our phones light up at 5 o'clock every day, because they're catching up from everything they couldn't handle while they're at their full-time job. The other thing you should be looking for is someone that's done 1,000 transactions, just like you do in an appraiser.
Yes, I agree.
Next is the unethical, how would you say this? Unethical behavior of holding back deposits because they think that there's no contract in place until that deposit has been delivered. Now, we've discussed on previous episodes that the deposit binds the contract, but it doesn't necessarily mean there isn't a contract. And that contract, when you write it, in my opinion, should be done in good faith. In other words, you're intending to follow through with that contract. You're intending to follow through with a condition that says you're going to deliver the deposit. Patty, you had some thoughts on this because you were dealing with an interesting situation recently.
What I find is either the real estate agent is advising their client, we've got the property secured, so that's peace of mind. Maybe they're traveling and you want to get it secured prior to their arrival so you can look at it. And if you chose not to move forward with it, you just don't have to bind the contract. Like, I know these things are being advised to buyers. They're not right to do. The other thing they will feel, if I don't bind the contract, or if I advise my client to not go ahead and bind the contract because they're so close to finding out if they've got their financing in order, now I don't have to identify them and go through the FinTrack process. These are things that I'm aware go on. Buyer beware. Please, I would not listen to this kind of advice, because you could find yourself, and there are cases in other provinces, you could find yourself in a bit of a situation.
Honesty is the best policy.
Correct.
Next, I still get phone calls from agents and potential buyers asking for directions to properties, or they can't find the property. My advice is, especially when you're looking at properties that are rural, go on the government mapping sites. There's a link in the show notes with every episode that will show you that site. I believe there's even a video to show you how to use it. Generate the GPS coordinates and use those. Do not use addresses for a number of reasons. One of which is we seem to have a lot of Wharf Road, Cemetery Roads, Arsenal Road.
Campbell Road.
Campbell Road. Like every time you bring an address up here, you get 9 and you don't know exactly which one it is. Plus the GPS sometimes misrepresents the location. You're looking for something in St. Peter's and it will tell you it's in Morrell. If I use the GPS coordinates, they're absolutely definitive, especially when you're showing properties to clients and you won't look like a fool because you can't find an address and you're supposed to be the local expert.
Well, for sure. And I've done that in my early years before I went ahead and bought. I have a Garmin GPS that I've always used. And thanks to you, Michael, you were insistent on it. And I have put in an address into my GPS, and it's taken me to the completely wrong property because it was done on short notice. And I quickly just booked this. I plugged it into my GPS and I drive. And now I've got to message my clients who were actually at the physical property and apologize to them that I took a 40-minute detour and I'll be on my way in the next hour. I will see you.
I had clients years ago type in an address on Water Street and they're in the wrong city. They were 45 minutes away.
Yeah, you also had a story, too, of a realtor that called you and they had a vehicle full of kids and clients and trying to navigate their way to the property.
We won't get into that. Amazingly, they're still licensed. You referred to a Schedule A a lot when people are buying properties. You keep saying, oh, refer to the Schedule A. What is the Schedule A? For those that don't know,
Schedule A.
It's a description of the property.
Well, yes, there's two Schedule A's, and this might be where some people might get a little confused. So there's a Schedule A on the deed, which is, like you said, Michael, the description of the property. It is the written form of the survey or the property description, defining where the property boundaries are, what they use to define the back southwest corner. It could have been a rock or a post, or there could actually be a marker there, depending on how long ago this was done. So there's that Schedule A. And then there's Schedule A within our contract, which is totally different. And I guess some people do get a little bit confused. Schedule A within our purchase and sale agreement is totally different. I call it the meat and potatoes of the contract. That's where all the clauses that protect the buyer are all included: title, search, financing, home inspection, insurance. However, what is Schedule B on the deed?
Well, let's just get back to Schedule A with reference to the deed and forget about the purchase and sale rabbit trail. The Schedule A on the deed tells you exactly what the property is. Usually, that's what you would give a surveyor to draw up a diagram that would illustrate what that property looks like. So that's the Schedule A she's talking about. And it does indeed reference to rivers and streams and water and high tide, medium or low tide, sometimes posts, wells, trees, you name it, anything can be in that deed. That's why it's important to give it to a surveyor, because the surveyor can validate those things actually exist. Schedule B, you can explain that. That's the restrictive and protective covenants.
Yeah, if there's an HOA.
I wouldn't call it a Schedule B. A lot of times they're just affixed, or the Schedule A will reference to the restrictive or protective covenants, but they may not actually be attached to the deed, but they should be.
They should be. But a lot of times you will see them as a Schedule B. So that's just a breakdown of the deed.
So the restrictive and protective covenants tell you what you can and cannot do with the land, and they should be affixed to the deed. And by affixing them to the deed, you're agreeing with what's within them. So they could potentially be enforced down the road, albeit probably not. The next thing on the list, you can cover that. So you're coming to the island looking for properties, and you told us this last night at 7 o'clock, and you'll be here at 9 a.m.
This happens a lot. Yes, it happens a lot. If you are planning a trip to PEI in any province, any location, please make pre-arrangements with a realtor. Try not to call every single listing agent and think you're just playing travel guide for your real estate needs on the island or the community that you're looking in, because it doesn't work out. This isn't something where you can book your vacation and book your flight separate and your accommodations and all your excursions or whatever the case is. When you're looking at properties, there's a lot of moving parts. And there's also the expertise of the realtor who will let you know what to expect in those certain areas. So you really should prearrange your travel arrangements to look, do your house hunting trip. Now, when you do get here and you're looking at properties, especially those who think they can go on their self-guided house hunting tour, I find this, Michael, so frustrating when they're about to leave and now they call up and they make you almost feel bad. We're catching a flight in 2 hours or 4 hours and we couldn't find anything. And this is the house that we think we want to buy. We need to get through now. We're outside. Can we get in? Have you received that as a request?
All the time, especially during tour season.
Yeah, tour season, which again, there's pros and cons to listing your house during the tour season because you feel like you're getting lots of activity, but not always with serious buyers. A lot of times they're tire kickers. Well, your client, your seller, feels all stressed out. They're trying their best to accommodate it because you want to make sure that they get the opportunity. I can tell you probably 75% of those do not end up buying. I don't know what you feel the stats are with that, Michael, but it is more than half are
I think it's important if you're a buyer's agent to make sure your buyers are qualified. They're ready to pull the trigger when they go through showings. Everyone that's involved with the buying decision is present. They either have the cash or the financing in place. They don't have a house to sell, or if they do, it's listed and it's listed at market value. And the list goes on and on and on. But when people vacation here, they'll be here for 2 weeks, but it will be 4 hours before their flight takes off that they'll contact an agent to go through a house. And of course, if they don't get through it, it's the complete end of the world. Additionally, if you are looking at properties in PEI and you've never been to the island, have a preemptive trip or come to the island or have a week to drive around the island first to determine what locations you like and don't like and understand the differences. Because there's big differences between East, West, South, North, South Shore, North Shore, Rustico, Surrey, Alberton, O'Leary, Tignish. You should know all these differences before you start booking showings. Would you agree with that?
I completely
Strongly agree. Okay, moving on. We heard a story, and this isn't the first time this has happened, where someone bought a house and found out after it closed that the driveway didn't belong to them, but their next door neighbor was nice enough to offer to sell it to them.
Yes, that has just happened this year.
It's happened a few times.
Yes, I know of a case where this has happened. The property, and these are clients of mine this has happened to, who now were in a situation. It was never something that I had noticed being their agent. And they bought this property, I believe, back in 2015 through me. So this is new. This isn't something like they just closed 6 months ago or a year ago and coming to discover this. They've been in this property now for 8 years or so before they ended up being told when the property exchanged hands next door, the new owners had a survey done and, oh, their driveway's on my property. I will go ahead and sell them their driveway back or they're going to have to relocate. So if you ever question the importance of getting a survey done prior to purchasing or a plot plan, yes, Michael. These are the reasons and these are the things that you could be faced with. Again, on the island, people pick up markers and they move them. It was not really a problem when I first moved to PEI 15 plus years ago. I find that since there's more and more non-island residents coming to PEI, again, over the last, say, even 7 years or so here, I'm finding they're far more litigious. They're far more... There's this proprietor, this is my property. I want to know exactly where my back corner is. Some of it's to do with putting up fencing for pets and children, but some of it's just, it's a mindset, it's a mentality. Just know 15, 20 years ago, that wasn't the mentality, the mindset on the island. They didn't care. In fact, when I first moved here, I had children walking through my backyard, which I had the Ontario mindset that this was my property. Why are people trespassing and going through? I quickly learned to just relax and it didn't matter. But I do find as more non-island, more off-island people that are coming here, they're very mindful of their property lines.
On a side note, at one point it was offensive to put up a fence.
I did ask my realtor when I moved here about putting up fencing around my property. And she was almost appalled that I would consider to do that. And she said, now I am from Ontario, originally. She just said, you might as well just put a sign out on your front lawn saying, I'm from Ontario. She said, because everyone is going to know that it was just a beacon out there. So I chose not to put a fence up.
I really think that if you're selling property, it should be like it is in some cities, states, and provinces where you have to have a survey. And if there's any structures or buildings or a driveway, there should be a plot plan that illustrates that. Particularly if you have a lot that's sort of odd. It's just not a perfect rectangle where it's easy to identify the corners. This particular lot I'm thinking of was on a court, so all the lots were kind of weird, not completely pie-shaped, but they sort of bent down in a rectangle and turned, and at this turn was where this one driveway was. Moving along, why would Patty want to become a real estate broker and open up Powerhouse Realty?
That is something that I chose to do back in 2018. One of the reasons I chose to be a broker or opened up my own company was I had enough leads coming in for my business. I was running a successful business and I wanted to share the leads. However, to know that in sharing leads, and we get into, you know, referrals and that agreements with the agents that you refer leads off to, I didn't feel like I could properly manage the agents. I've had leads that I've sent out to many agents where they never followed up with them. They didn't have the proper education and training. And obviously the brokerage was taking an extra piece on top of the leads that I had generated based on my marketing, you know, expertise and experience. I also wanted a culture that everyone was like-minded. It was very important to me. I didn't like going into the office and feeling like I had to keep big secrets. And I didn't want, not that there is any secrets in real estate. It's hard work and education. But I just felt everyone was wanting to see what I had going on. I didn't like the cultures. So I decided to open up my own brokerage. What's important in a brokerage to me, culture is very important, like-minded individuals, a place where you like to go in and enjoy, you know, your coworkers, a cohesiveness. There is a lot of responsibility. I find there are a lot of brokerages opening up on the island, and I don't think they realize what the expectations are, what's required of them. If you're considering opening up a brokerage, you should have, like we have mentioned here, the experience, 10,000 hours, 1,000 transactions. You want a broker that's going to be able to foresee and help you circumvent any issues, that's going to have the infrastructure and the education support behind you. Also, make sure that you have a team that you're not competing with. I felt I was always competing with the agents within my brokerages before that I was with, almost to the point where it became a celebratory moment if they beat me and got the client that I didn't get. I really didn't like that kind of culture and environment. So for my brokerage, those were the things that were important. And again, we already mentioned at the beginning how do realtors get paid. Just know that based on whatever your expectations or support level, the split, you get what you pay for. So if you want a really good split, you're probably going to be compromising some of the services. If you're okay paying a split, but if somebody could give you the education and the support and a culture that is conducive to growth and development for yourself, therefore better servicing the clients. Because at the end of the day, this is all about providing a better quality service and better real estate experience for your client or customer.
And making sure that the broker is well capitalized, so they're not closing their office within the first year of opening it like we've seen here recently.
Yeah, there's been some situations. Again, I just think it's lack of education and realizing. The only reason why I did on top of this is I went through an extensive, Michael, if I can just say, three-year coach training program. And I also, and I think still to this day, I'm the only one on the island. And if you're listening to this in the future, maybe that's not true anymore, but I have my CRB, which is Certified Real Estate Broker Management Certification. And as of today that we've done this, that's very important.
Land videos, super exciting or what?
Not exactly exciting, but in very important.
Informative if they're done right?
Yes, I agree.
So what would be in a land video that would be helpful? Do you want me to start?
Yeah, go right ahead, Michael.
So I recently did one of Cape Egmont, Arsenal Road, I think it is. And I didn't include this because this one touches the paved road. But what I like to see in a land video is I'd like to see from the ground the drive in, particularly if it's in a cottage subdivision or the entry road's 2 miles long, like some of them you see in Savage Harbor and other areas, Donaldston. I also want to see aerial views with a drone. I want to see what the beach looks like up and down. I want to see elevation from the drone so I know what's miles down the beach in either direction. Is there a city? Is there a wharf? Churches? Whatever the case may be. Confederation Bridge. I'd like to see a circle around the land. I'd like to see a picture of the survey or a ortho photo, which is not legally 100% correct, but at least it gives me a guide as to what I'm looking at. Maybe we could walk the property if it's treed and see what kinds of trees are in it. I've done that before. I did one out in Grand Tracadie where I actually walked from one end to the other. And actually, that property sold right away because of that, because the off-island buyer gave them a real feel for the property. I find that land videos, if done properly, are very helpful. They're certainly a lot better than some of the listings we're looking at, which aren't selling because the buyer can't get a feel for it, where they got two properties from, you know, through the window of their truck of a picture of two trees.
Yeah. And a lot, you will see a lot of land listings where they're standing at the road, taking a picture of the trees that are...
So I'm talking about the ditch. And the other thing is include the GPS coordinates, because land, unless there is a building permit applied for, does not have an address. So the GPS coordinates, you just type them in, Bob's your uncle, brings you to the land. And in some cases, if the land is large, I've even included the GPS coordinates of all the corners and the property lines, which is helpful, particularly when you're walking a property, which, after your comment, we'll get to mapping and walking.
So all I was going to say with regards to sometimes placing a temporary photo on the property, we've had weeks of rain. I have a property that is still needing some really good quality photos, but I can't get my drone off the ground. What would you do in that situation?
What I would do if I was you is I'd go out and spend the $40,000 or $50,000 in a commercial drone that will run in the rain.
Okay, well, I won't be doing that. Sometimes there are reasons, but they shouldn't be on for too long, especially if your seller wants this on the market ASAP.
What you could do is absolutely have a picture of the ortho with a survey. If you wanted to go out there in the rain, take some pictures from the ground, but also make it clear that more pictures are forthcoming when the rain ever stops, if it ever does.
Okay.
Next, walking properties and property lines. I still get phone calls from even agents and brokers asking me, what's that utility you use on your phone so you can actually see the satellite view and the property lines as you're walking, Patty?
Yeah, I have had...
Do you use that?
Yes, I do use it.
And you find it helpful?
It is very helpful, but I usually use it representing sellers and kind of going through and getting an idea so that I can describe, or at least I'm able to over the phone. I don't really deal with a lot of buyers that would cause me to have to go walking acreages.
Well, not necessarily you walking it, but let's just say you're looking for land hypothetically. The tools that I would have with me are three tools. I would have my cell phone with me with the Realtor.ca app. I would select land in the criteria, so I'm not looking at houses, mini homes, commercial real estate, and farms. I would also have the mapping utility, which the link will be in the show notes here, along with a pile of other utilities. We refer to it as the PEI Agra app, which basically shows you the property from the satellite as you're walking. Your cell phone will not work without cellular coverage, and unfortunately, a lot of people are looking at waterfront that is on the water, but you don't have any cellular coverage. So as an alternate, I would bring a handheld GPS that I can enter GPS coordinates into, and I would calculate those coordinates prior to visiting the property, so I have a backup.
So how much are those handheld GPS?
I haven't bought one recently, but a few hundred dollars.
Okay.
We're not talking thousands. I always buy Garmin GPSs. That's all I will use. But I'm sure there's probably some third-party knockoff that's probably $100 or something. Who knows?
Well, and if you end up misidentifying your property and someone's going to sell you your driveway back perhaps a couple $100s if you are looking at making a purchase of land. You're paying a couple $100s for a home inspection. Maybe if it is a bit of an acreage property or something that could be disputed, it might be a very good investment.
The other thing it will tell you is the elevation of the property, which is kind of neat to know how far you are above sea level, particularly if you're building, putting wells and septic systems in. I think that just about wraps it up. I will make a little side note here that I did add both Patty and my email addresses to the show notes, which would give you the perfect opportunity to give the podcast a 5-star rating and also give us any feedback. And if you have any questions about Prince Edward Island in general or PEI real estate, shoot us an email, text, or a phone call, and we would love to cover that.
Yeah, absolutely.
If it's interesting. If it's not, we're just going to delete that message.
No, I'm
not answer the phone.
There is no bad questions. I would welcome any kind of feedback or questions so that we can cover you and your concerns in a future episode for sure.
Thank you for listening, everybody. Have a great day, and we'll see you on the next rainy episode.
Hopefully the sun is shining the next time we meet, Michael.
It absolutely will be.
Have a great day, everybody. Talk to you soon.
Bye for now.